contributions to the profession is the fact that he looked up young, good people and gave them a break. Rank said that Whiteman, contrary to what I'd been led to believe, wasn't always that as well organized a businessman, that Whiteman got drunk himself sometimes, pretty much, but not on jobs or anything of the sort, but he said he was a pretty jovial kind of fellow. Rank told a long story about Chester Hazlitt, and surprisingly that's the way his name is pronounced, Chester Hazlitt, the great clarinetist with Whiteman, how they'd been playing an engagement in New Orleans. He said the engagements were always the same, that you played Rhapsody in Blue and you played something else, and he went through the Whiteman book. It's what the public expected, but it was good work. Incidentally, Rank said that he obtained the polish on his trombone working with Whiteman. When I first talked to Rank, I heard him play in this beautiful, velvety, sort of creamy tone and highly sophisticated improvisation with a single note or so now and then, quite surprisingly, in that bottom register, the way the early trombonists like Mole and Rank used to do. And I said, well, Mr. Rank, the trombone that I heard on the Wolverine records and the early ones just doesn't sound like this. And he smiled and said, well, you know, I had a long time with Paul Whiteman. Of course, he'd been playing horn ever since. He must be playing somewhere because his lip is just in perfect, perfect condition. Well, anyway, they were playing in New Orleans, and Chester Hazlitt got hold of a whole bottle of absinthe, apparently pure absinthe, and he got to drinking this and sucking away on it. Then they went over to Baton Rouge to play a concert, and Hazlitt, who was a very important man in the organization, had one long solo that was swing for show and another one that was highly technical, and he played the first solo and I guess just messed it up. And people, the audience really didn't know any better, and they applauded like anything. And Whiteman looked at Hazlitt and said, in effect, you know, what are you doing? And then Hazlitt came back with the technical passage he was supposed to play, and Rank said he messed that up even worse. His fingers were all thumbs and so on, and Whiteman was very angry. And between the sets in the wings, the first thing Whiteman did was walk up to Hazlitt and say, you're fired. You're fired as of tomorrow. He said, of course, he wasn't. Whiteman hired him back. But he said Paul had to put up, of course, with all sorts of things, and he did it. He knew musicians, and he did it in friendly fashion and well. He and Gino Pendergrass, who was also the Gulpet Band, were talking with me about Jack Teagarden. Most of the musicians really were filled with anecdotes rather than things about the music themselves. You know, what happened here, what happened there. Teagarden apparently was a sucker for women. He kept getting married, I think they said, four times. And he also liked dogs. Apparently he kept big dogs at his home in California. But anyway, Rank said in this New Orleans date, apparently they were traveling in a Pullman car, or on a series of Pullman cars, on their one-night stands or concerts around the country. And he said after one concert he saw Teagarden, who was fairly well along in drinking, with a big blonde all bespangled hanging onto his arm, and Rank said to himself, there goes Jack again. Well, he said he woke up in the morning in his Pullman berth and opened the curtains and started to get out, and he looked and Teagarden's berth was across from me, and he said the curtains were partly open, and sticking out of the curtains was a great big ass, and it wasn't Jack's. He didn't know quite what to do, because this, you know, created quite a scandal. So he called the band manager, his name was Horvath, and said, you know, look. And Horvath slapped this butt, and this big blousy bond sort of rolled out, and Hazlitt said, Horvath said, you know, get your pants on and get out of here. And she said, I will, but call me a cab. And he said, there we were in a railroad siding far from anywhere. Not much of a story, but indicative of the kind of things these people told. The most rewarding man to talk to was Chalice, who was, I think the musicians themselves, many of them are more or less limited men whose musicianship is excellent, but who don't think too deeply about what they're doing. Chalice, on the other hand, who started out, incidentally, as a reed man, is conceptual. He thinks about the music and thinks about the whole drift of things. He has almost a historical sense. He went to Bucknell, and he wanted to go on to law school. In fact, he said he'd sent his deposit into the University of Pennsylvania, and he, through his association with the Dorseys, and apparently he'd played with some of the bands around coal towns in Pennsylvania, he began arranging, and he said he did get admitted to Penn Law School, but never went. And our conclusion was that there, but for the grace of God, today he'd been a practicing wealthy attorney. But to go back to Bix, what Challis was getting at, I think, was in Bix was the sheer musician's talent, I suppose, his unerring ear, his knowledge of music, his taste, what he called his economy, his restraint. Challis himself is a well-educated man, musically, that is. He has arranged all his life, and while he didn't go to conservatory, he knows music thoroughly and carefully. And the thing that kept impressing me was his great respect for, admiration for Bix's musical talent. I suggested to him that Bix was moving away from cornet toward piano and composing in the latter years. I didn't get really too much response to this, but it was perfectly clear from what Challis was saying that in those later years, Bix was working apparently all the time, composing, thinking things up, working on piano, which he said he found somewhere, extending his musical knowledge. And while his my suggestion that Bix was moving away from his horn, Challis really didn't go for. I didn't get any response to this. Challis's remark that the legend of Bix began in Bix's own time was interesting. Apparently this was true. The musicians I talked to, Rank and Morehouse and Pendergast, that was the impression I got. What they remembered were the things that Bix had said and that he'd done. They didn't really pay much attention to the romanticizing of the legend and this kind of thing, but rather, obviously, here was a man that they considered, even when they were working with him or knew about him, as a person around whom legends gathered. Rank was with Whiteman for 11 years, incidentally. He also played as a freelance and with Adrian Rollini and Sam Lannon and Nat Shilkret, and then had his own band in Cincinnati and apparently still plays. Challis has a fantastic musical memory, in fact, a fantastic memory. He probably, of course, has talked about this with interviewers for some time. Apparently he's never written anything down much, but he remembers the things that he did in arranging a piece like San in 1928 or whenever it was. He has a recall for, I guess, just about all the arrangements he ever did. If you say to him, you know, did you arrange that? He'll say yes or no, or he'll say, well, now that one I did this on. Do you remember that phrase, the deedle, 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 and how I fixed that background up? Most amazing musical memory. I asked Challis about the relationship between the Gold Kit Band and the Fletcher Henderson Band, both of whom were playing at Roseland. I think that was the Gold Kit Band's last engagement. It's where Rex Stewart and Bix Beiderbecke shared a locker. In Rex Stewart's account, he said that the Gold Kit Band came into Roseland and cut them completely to pieces, and that they stole Gold Kit arrangements, mostly by Challis. Challis said that it wasn't stealing, that they exchanged arrangements. He said that Don Redman arrangements were excellent, and he and Redman knew each other well and had worked together. And he also said, I thought rather amusingly, that they had a very clever young fellow named Benny Carter who was also doing arrangements at the time. Another thing that Challis said in talking about economy of notes in regard to Bix and his trumpet was that Bobby Hackett played far too many notes. He didn't seem to think a lot of Hackett's style. I didn't question him any further on it. But he said, too, that also about Andy Sechrest, who replaced her rather was supposed to replace Bix with Whiteman, that he played too many notes too. Chalice obviously has sort of a classical view, a very disciplined view on horn. And this criticism of Hackett, or the statement probably, is worth recording.
The expression of the individual comes out spontaneously as a part of himself. It's only natural that with his great love and interest in music, that he wasn't interested in high school mathematics, speaking, rhetoric, or anything else. He was interested in playing and in being a musician, and a jazz musician. For the benefit of those who are watching, this is Bix's home. We're sitting out on the front porch, and I think you get a little flavor of the architectural and the, well, perhaps we may call it a little gingerbread today, but this was a very fine home and in a very fine neighborhood. The Beiderbecke family were in, we'll say in the social structure, were above average. Mr. Beiderbecke owned a lumber and coal supply company, so that they were affluent. Bix, of course, had many advantages other than the average person. Bix had a breakdown in the fall of 1929. He had to be sent home for recuperation. We got together and had many, many enjoyable hours going over his career, his music, his recording. The last two winters that Bix lived, he played here at Danceland Ballroom. He played with the band Jimmy Hicks and his orchestra, a very fine band, very talented people in it. Ended up with a breakdown and came back home. By the time that he recovered, it seemed like a good idea that we get him in the band down here. So we talked the manager into hiring Bix as a special attraction as a part of the band. Dancing was a popular avocation and recreation of people those days. We used to pack crowds in here on Saturday nights up as high as 1,500 people. Bix was better known in Podunk, New York, Chicago, any place in the United States than he was here. So we thought that it would be quite an attraction, but it was no particular attraction. Bix was in a rundown condition. He had a far greater social life than did the average musician. Bix was sort of brought into the social thing. People admired him and wanted to say, I knew Bix Beiderbecke. I bought Bix Beiderbecke a drink, and boy, we drank together. And perhaps at times, maybe he did drink when he didn't want to drink. True friends of Bix have always said that it was Bix's friends who contributed to his death.
My dad's name was Howard, and Howard insisted that Howard